the National Weather Service. Sunny and warm today, a high of 83. And again, a red flag fire warning today from 11 a.m. until 8 p.m. Right now, wind southwest at 7, 64 degrees Kenosha, 61 in Racine. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Welcome you to the Thursday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Delighted to welcome back into our studios for her monthly visit to the program, Nan Calvert. And I know Nan is exceptionally excited about the two guests that she has with her in our studios today to talk about a group called the Watershed Protection Committee of Racine County. So first, Nan Calvert, we welcome you back to the program. And tell us about your first encounter with these two gentlemen and this organization that you were so anxious to highlight on the program today.
Well, thanks, Greg. I'm very, very happy to be back. Yes, so the last time that Chairman Holloway was with us, he did mention the Watershed Protection Committee of Racine, and I didn't know anything about it. You Google a little bit, and then you email a little bit, and you find out that this is a very important group working within Racine County, made up of people in the agricultural community, made up of farmers who, number one, understand the essential nature of soil health, understand the connection between soil and water, and certainly want to preserve the integrity of our watersheds. And so I thought it was really important for people to hear about this group and what they're doing, because I think a lot of people who don't live in a more agricultural community don't understand what farmers are trying to do. It's new and important, and I'm so happy we have this group in Racine.
Very, very good. So for the second time on the morning show, we have with us John Holloway, who is the chairperson for the town of Paris and a farmer there in the area. And John Holloway joined us last time, actually, to talk about a really interesting solar power initiative in the town of Paris. And with us today, I'm pretty sure for the first time on the morning show, Brian Gunderson, who is a grain farmer around Waterford, and he is one of the officers for the Watershed Protection Committee of Racine County. Vice chair right now, maybe, or something?
Yes.
Okay, very good. So we're so happy that both of you can be here to talk about this group. Nan, it's kind of interesting, you know, as somebody who's been so deeply involved with Root Pike Win over all these years, it was probably kind of amazing maybe for you to even discover that there was this group, in a sense, working on many of the same issues, but in a sense not on the same wavelength as Root Pike Win.
Yes, I mean, I was thrilled to find out about it because you know, traditional farming practices, as Brian and I were chatting about before we came on air, can be extremely detrimental to soil health, but there are ways to fix that. And that has to come from within the environmental community. I don't think you can have people standing on the outside who aren't farmers going, you have to do this differently. Mm. You know, that realization has to come within, from within.
Very good. Let's get to know each of you a little bit. And of course, we've already met John Holloway, but John, in particular, I'd just be interested in knowing kind of your background specifically as a farmer and the kind of farming that you do right now and so on. And we'll ask Brian the same question in a moment.
Good morning, Greg. I live on a farm in town of Paris. I'm the fifth generation of our family to own and operate the farm. At this point in time, I'm primarily just a cash grain operation, one-man operation. But when you have the land in a family for that long, you know that you're creating a legacy and you're trying to hand it down to the next generation in at least as good of shape as it was when your father and whatnot handed it down. So I'm always interested in learning ways that that you can enhance it. Some of it is that wanting to be more sustainable is part of my motivation. So trying to be a student.
We all need to learn, that's for sure. How about you, Brian Gunderson? Tell us a little bit about your background specifically as a farmer. And is your story kind of similar to John's or different?
Well, so I believe I'm the seventh generation on our homesteaded farm.
Wow.
And so my father was very proactive in farming conservatively, and I've lived through that. So this group that we're involved in really intrigued me to learn and do the right thing for the environment.
Hmm. So in other words, your father had maybe some of these similar concerns when he was farming himself.
Yeah, he started no-tilling in the middle years of his life, and we saw very good results out of that, and so we've ran with that ever since. I think he started in 1982, and that's the way we've done it now. The cover crop regenerative farming has just taken it to a new level. So
great. Well, we'll explore all of that and what exactly that means. Tell us what you know about the creation of this group, the Watershed Protection Committee of Racine County, and have you been a part of it from day one?
Well, the president who, this was his idea, Tom Grile, neighbor of mine, he had read about the DADCAP producer-led, farmer-led groups, and we got together and got some people together and formed a group to apply for grants to do these practices that DADCAP was in favor of, but it was the farmers kind of teaching the people by what your goals were how you were scored to receive grant money, and that grant money we used to cost share and promote cover crops and buffer strips. And so that's kind of how it started, and it's grown and grown and grown. And we have we work with a collaborator of Racine County. He's our conservationist of Racine County, Chad Sampson. He's been a very big help, and he likes what we're doing. It fits what he was trained to do and what he does at the county. So he's a big help, and I think we got about 20 members with about a dozen very hardcore members that meet pretty regularly it's kind of like Alcoholics Anonymous. we meet to support each other, and we all try different things. We learn from each other, and then we try to educate the public, from the consumer to the other farmers.
Fantastic. Great.
And Greg, one of the importance of this group is that many of us started going into no-till, like Brian said, in the 80s, and you struggled on your own. You played around with this. You made your mistakes. You innovated, but you tended to do it all on your own. And And it was hard to for the idea to grow. Whereas now with this group is that I can learn from people who are actually doing it. So Brian does it on a larger scale. I just dabble in it until I'm more comfortable with it. But in many ways, it's being able to meet as a group, exchange ideas. So Brian talks about the group of about 20 that regularly meet, that the group holds seminars, a winter workshop, and a summer field day. And we've had as many as 100 people, 120 people attend that. So wow. there's a core group, but then there's also the platform to speak to a larger group.
Fantastic. And that's where widespread change can start to really happen. Yep. Yeah, great. For those of you just joining us, today's morning show is the monthly visit of Nan Calvert. And she has brought with her today two special guests, both from the Watershed Protection Committee of Racine County. Brian Gunderson, a grain farmer from right around Waterford, who is the vice chair of the committee. And John Holloway, who's been on the program before. He's the chairperson for the town of Paris and a farmer in the Paris area. And John, it's probably important for us to underscore that even though this committee has the name Racine County attached, that in fact it is not exclusively for farmers in Racine County, and you happen to be a member of this. Tell us about how you even found out about it.
Fortunately, Brian and my lives have interacted on any number of levels, and we try to visit on a somewhat regular basis. And so Brian made me aware of what he was doing, and then Tom Grile is a good friend of mine as well. Tom had actually invited me to sit in on a meeting, and so that's how I became involved in my life. I've been involved in a number of watershed projects in Kenosha County, so it was kind of a natural fit for myself. And as Brian had indicated, his family's adventure into no-till, somewhat parallel time frame of mine, and there are a number of fairly dynamic people. Tom Burlingham, active in this group. Adam Lash, farmer from Walworth County, who is just a tremendous, knowledgeable person that is so willing to share all of his knowledge and information, and that's just been tremendously valuable.
Cool. So let's talk a little bit about this term that you've been bandying about, the whole thing about no-till farming. So first of all, let's talk first of all about what it means when you don't do that. I mean, what is more standard practice, and what is the problem with that kind of farming, or what are the potential harms?
Well, this would be my belief, but when you're conventional farming and working the soil, it's like taking the paint off of a piece of metal. So the piece of metal oxidizes, rusts, and that's how I look at the soil. When you till it, you oxidize it. Every time you till it, you have less. So when what we're trying to do, or what my family has tried to do, is not till the soil, not size the particulars to a smaller fraction. I don't know if you've all smelt soil, but if you're a farmer and you plow, you can smell the soil. And from what I understand, when you can smell that, that's a plume of carbon that's leaving your soil. So by not tilling, my belief is you have something better than if you till it. And
so when a farmer is tilling the soil in kind of that other practice, that's what we're talking about, like with a plow and just going into the dirt. What has the purpose of that tilling been? I mean, why do most farmers do that?
Well, it started because of herbicides. There was no herbicides for weeds in your crop, your row crop. So you did tillage to destroy the weeds. But now, today's day and age, or for a long time, we've got herbicides to control weeds. So in our practice of no-till, without tilling the soil and putting weed seeds back into a germ zone, we actually use less chemical than a conventional farmer.
Interesting. Now, I would have thought that tilling the soil was also part of the process of planting. I mean, how do you plant things if you just have the straight soil? Are there means by which to plant without disturbing the soil?
Well, when we first started it was difficult. It required stronger equipment, more down pressure to get your whatever you needed to force into the soil without it being tilled. But we're finding as we no-tilled longer, it was easier to get the equipment into the soil. So, and technology of different equipment, so we're able to, you know, move a minimal amount of trash, open a slot, put your seed in, close it, just like you do in conventional, but maybe a little different equipment. But as you get into this longer, the soil gets a little more resilient, a little softer. And then when you introduce cover crops, it takes it even to a better level of tilth and airspace in the soil. Hmm. The ability for water to infiltrate into that soil.
And our experience is the same as Brian's, is that when we first started no-tilling in 83 is when we first went to, is that we had to run a coulter in front of the corn planter to open that slot mechanically. And now after all these years is that we took the coulters off of our corn planter. We're able to plant in that soil and get the depth that we need using just the conventional openers on the planter. So it is a process. And then with soybeans, we use a no-till drill that we're able to plant into corn stubble. And it just uses a single disc slightly at an angle that's able to open a slot deep enough for, so it does respond. And then as Brian is showing that the cover crop also changes the soil. And so that people planting into a cover crop often experience an even easier soil penetration because the roots have opened up that soil and have created more of a more natural seedbed than what we're saying conventional tillage did. Hmm.
So in other words, over the years that you've done this, you can see with your own eyes the way in which the nature of your soil has changed. It's not some invisible change, you know, way down deep, but even just, you know, on the surface and in the most obvious ways, the soil on your farm has been changed for the better because of this practice. Is that right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Brian, does that resonate with you? I mean, has that also been your experience?
Oh, yeah. Yep. Same deal, yep.
Scientifically, do we know exactly what happens to the soil when we till it? Or is that something we're still kind of struggling to understand exactly what's going on in terms of the damage that can be done to soil when it is tilled in the conventional way?
Oh, well, like I said before, when you size that organic matter and release that plume of carbon to the atmosphere, that's no doubt that's happening. But whenever you run a piece of steel in the soil to try to condition soil, it's in my belief it's not the best way to do it. Leaving the soil alone and letting worms and all the living things that should be in soil. I should make a point about that. I believe a lot of this conventional till, people are, well, we can prove it by the soil tests that people that are doing conventional till, it's actually a media that they're planting their seed into, but it's not soil. It's not a living a living substance.
Right. They're probably killing a lot of the organisms that are there that would make the soil healthier.
And over the years, herbicides, insecticides, you know, we always battle some kind of an insect or a weed, and we've gotten where we've destroyed every one of them. But along with that, if we try to kill 3 harmful nematodes, we kill 1,000 good nematodes.
Mm.
Or beetles. Beetles are a predator of slugs. So when you kill one thing, you also kill all the beneficials.
Mm. Nan Calvert is smiling and nodding. This speaks right to your heart, doesn't it?
Right, because everything is connected. It doesn't live separately, one thing from the other. A few years ago, we had on a soils expert, this really dynamic young woman from the DNR, and I apologize, I don't remember her name, but she went into great detail about, and Brian was talking about this too earlier, about how soil is a living thing. And mostly we regard it as just something we plant things in or whatever, you know, it's this sort of inanimate thing, but it isn't. It's chock full of this microbiotic community that makes it a sort of a living, breathing thing, if you will, that makes it healthy. And there are all these interactions that go on underground that, of course, we don't see. And then there are all those tiny little things that work in between the spaces of the soil molecules and the water molecules. And in, you know, when you till it, it disrupts that structure. Mm. And so these things that are supposed to be there are no longer there. And that, therefore, your soil isn't healthy anymore. And it doesn't sustain the rest of life that depends on soil. And it's just wonderful to hear that people whose lives and livings depend on the soil are making this realization, you know. And you know, I was thinking, too, we talk about people being on their land and farming for generations. Does this group interact with future farmers of America, young people who want to go into farming?
Yeah, absolutely. Is the Union Grove FFA and Waterford FFA generally send their groups to the seminars. I think the soil pits that the FFA soil competition team has practiced using the soil pits that are dug at the demonstrations and whatnot. So, yes, absolutely. They've engaged with FFA and younger people.
Oh, that's wonderful to hear.
Cool. Yeah, every one of our field days, we've been digging a soil pit. And it sounds very boring, but Jamie Patton, a specialist in soil in the state, she has been running our soil pits since we've had them. And she makes it very interesting. And everybody leaves the soil pit learning something and a whole new perspective of what soil is.
Mm-hmm. So can you describe what that exactly is? Is it just a big hole that people can go in and look at, or what exactly is that?
Well, you really need someone to show you what you should be looking at, but she can show the in a healthy soil, the black dirt will increase, the depth of black dirt will permeate down. And then just showing all the life of the soil, the wormholes, how a root will follow a wormhole to get moisture. There's many things in a soil pit that.
And Craig, by a soil pit, what we're talking about is the day of a demonstration. They have a backhoe come in and dig a trench, probably about 4 feet deep. Try to do it representatively. 2 years ago, we did it with one pit was in the edge of a field into an area that had never been tilled. It was on the edge of a wooded area to show what a native soil was, then to go out into an area that had been conventionally tilled. And then eventually we are on this demonstration farm is having cover crop over a number of years and then going into that and be able to physically walk from one to the next.
So you walk in this trench.
Yeah, you can walk down and
you can look closely at the soil, see it with your own eyes.
And wow. Jamie's primary tool once the pit is dug is a pocket knife, and she's able to show you the separation. She's able to show you compaction. She's able to show you the different textures of the soil compared one way to the other.
Fascinating. So when you have your workshops, that is your committee for farmers and others in the agricultural community, specifically on this matter of no tilling, what are the kinds of things that get talked about at these workshops or demonstrated? I mean, in other words, you know, what is there for farmers to learn about this aside from, you know, don't do this? Is it about helping farmers understand how to do something else instead and how to do that the best they can?
Well, when we started our field day would be at a local farm, one of us that are doing these practices. But I need to thank Racine County. Racine County has given us like 50 acres in the town of, or the village of Rochester to have a research farm. So two of our last field days have been at that location. So at that location, we've tried. It wasn't very successful. Last year, we had a cover crop species plot, and only about a third of them were worth keeping because of the dry weather, the droughty ground that was there. But so that's one thing, is we try to show people what the species look like. Ideally, it would be nice to have a soil pit with those species, because the species will root differently. But on that research farm, we showed our research there. And now going forward, like next year, we'll be able to share a little more on how the results were. We shared some of that at our winter workshop. And it's a spot to be in the field. We set up a tent. We have lunch. So maybe a feel-good feeling to be out in the field and yeah. see some of the practices.
Sounds fantastic.
But the other thing is that the committee has tried to bring in each year a nationally known a person that can bring their experience, and generally we're trying to find somebody who's had long-term success with it, because it is not an inexpensive process. So you might ask, why isn't everybody adopting this? Why isn't everybody doing it? And there are a number of challenges with it. One is that you're basically increasing the cost of seed, because you're, to do the cover crops, you're taking off your crop that you're selling for money, and then planting a second crop. So you have seed cost and application and whatnot, so that you, and there isn't an immediate first year return on this.
Right.
By bringing in nationally renowned experts, it does give farmers a little bit sense of, here's somebody who did it, this is what he did, this is our he or she, and this is what worked for them. And some of them have have amazing results. But it does affect how you physically, so we learn from each other, is how are you getting it planted in the fall? You have a narrow window. You need to get this established before it freezes and snows. And so we learn from each other from that. What species you plant as your cover crop makes a difference as to what benefit you're going to get. And then it depends on what you're trying to do. Are you trying to get a species that is helping break up hard pan and break up actual physical problems with the soil? Or are you trying to use that crop, the cover crop, to sequester nitrogen, so it pulls up nitrogen and holds it, so during the wintertime it doesn't leach off? Or are you trying to use it so that it actually will make the available nutrients in the soil more available? Some nutrients are not naturally available to corn and soybeans, which is our crop that we're raising for money, whereas some of the cover crops can help with mineralization of the, you know, you have the, you take the soil test. My soil tests show that my soil is excessively high in phosphorus, but it's not available. Whereas if I plant the right cover crop, it can make that more available and whatnot. So that's why you need to have outside people come in to share, this is what worked for me, this is how I'm doing it.
Right. And I guess it's probably a thing about learning from each other's successes and also learning from each other's mistakes, because I'm sure sometimes a choice gets made and maybe it wasn't the best mistake, and that's a learning opportunity too.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Can you talk about the kinds of things, the species that you use for cover crops, and the different benefits that they produce?
And actually, before we even get into those specifics, just for the city slickers like me listening, maybe even start with just the most basic idea of what a cover crop is and what the point is in general, and then let's get into some of those specifics. But what do we mean when we're talking about a cover crop?
Well, let me tell you about my story. When I first heard about this, and I heard Ray Archuleta, he was an NRCS person for 30 years trying to do conservation in Missouri. And when I first heard him and I came home and I got thinking about what he all had to say. So I'm I'm sitting in my shop looking out at a forest that no one tills it, nobody fertilizes it, it grows tons of biomass, and it's not deficient in anything.
Hmm.
And it comes
What's wrong with this picture?
Yeah. So in my farm field, I've got depleted soil. I need nutrients every year. And I'm just trying to put my hands around this. And come to find out, in that forest, you got mycorrhizal fungi that's living in that soil. To get from, and a lot of this is what I understand about this. I mean, this is quite a journey. I don't know everything, but from what I've heard, that mycorrhizal fungi takes a living root 9 months to get established. And once you get that established, that is part of the life of the soil. The mycorrhizal is able to carry nutrients to where it needs to go. It's a spider web of a grid under the soil. So that's one of the key things that really hit me. I wish I was 20 years old when I learned this, not 40, 45 or 46 years old when I started learning this.
So you would have started doing this quite a long time ago then, probably.
Yeah, if I would have paid attention more. And I don't know if the information was there and I just bypassed it or what it was, but somehow it hit me that I've got to do this. I've got to challenge myself to learn this and do it.
Yeah, fantastic. So when you plant a cover crop, are you planting a crop that in a sense is on top of or right with the actual thing you're planting? Or is this something you plant when you're not planting your cash crop?
It means a lot of things. It's like you get a group of farmers together. We could all generally agree, one, you got to plant corn. The window, you got to plant corn. Cover crops, you can interseed it in your corn crop. You can plant it after your corn crop. There's really no right or wrong, and I don't think we'll ever know the answer of when to do it and how to do it. Even within our core group, we will not agree on how to do it. Mm. And
so a cover crop is something that you don't harvest. I mean, you're not planting it for that purpose. You're planting it for another purpose.
As Brian said, it can mean different things. Some people, they supplement it, so they plant their cover crop in the late fall, and then they in the spring they let it go to seed and harvest the seed so that they have either to replant the area or sell to other people. But generally, cover crops, because we have such a narrow window because of our shorter growing season, the idea is to keep a growing root on the soil year-round.
So, all the time. So.
So in the fall, you would plant a cover crop to get established so that it'd be a growing plant during the winter and early spring, and then you would either plant into that green, which they say you leave that growing and you plant into it, and then you destroy that growing crop either by rolling it down or spraying it, and then the corn crop is, or the soybeans are what's the green root. But it can be almost anything. Is that some of us is just as simple as planting some oats in the spring, just to have that activity, and then you plant into it. Some people are hoping to get some benefit of nutrient sequestration, and so they're planting a particular species that will do that. One of the natural ones is people who plant winter wheat, which is generally harvested in July, is that then if following that, if you plant a cover crop, then you can plant the tillage turnips and radishes, deep-rooted, those type of things that actually physically change the soil. you have a little bit more flexibility. What we struggle with here is in the fall, you're trying to get the crop off, you're trying to plant a cover crop, you're trying to get everything you need to get done, and that's one of the challenges.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Does that answer your question, Ann? I didn't mean to hijack before.
That's okay.
But
it's your show, Greg. Yeah. You can do whatever you want.
Well, I was just really struggling to understand just even the most basic sense what a cover crop is.
Right.
And so
I
have a better idea now.
I mean, I knew that, for a while I've known that farmers plant winter wheat, but I think it's evolved beyond winter wheat now, particularly when you're talking about nutrient sequestration and, you know, planting in between the corn rows. And I think it's evolved way beyond winter wheat at this point with various and sundry species. So is clover a cover crop? What other kinds of species?
Some people do use clover. It has its value because it's a legume. It is also a difficult. It's a strong competitor and somewhat difficult to get it to stop growing so that it isn't as used as much as around here. Quite a few people are using winter rye, which has, as Brian said, creates that network of mat of roots, which both stabilizes the soil and sequesters nutrients.
You know, that's the other part of cover cropping is soil stabilization. Because, you know, when fields are left bare with no vegetation, there's runoff, of course, which carries it into the nearest waterway and causes a whole bunch of problems. But then the wind blows and it picks up particulate matter and it goes somewhere. So eventually when it lands, it also gets back into the water system. And we know, and, you know, farmers know more than anybody, our topsoil reserves are just dwindling like crazy. And so having a cover crop prevents erosion, controls erosion, really important.
So you just hold on to that beautiful soil that much longer.
Yeah, this is a term that I stole from Ray Archuleta, but he calls it armoring the soil. So covering the soil with a living crop. And then even when that crop dies, you're still covered with that biomass that died. But, yeah, so if you protect the soil, you don't have wind erosion. You don't have near the water erosion. And then you got the nutrient
sequestration.
Yes, where you're not allowing the nutrients to leach through the soil. You're trying to put those into another crop that can give them back to you later.
Right, and it's holding on to carbon dioxide. You know, it's not leaching out into the atmosphere as well. So many important benefits.
Yeah. And something to think about when you plant, say, so our corn and beans are a monoculture that only grow half the year. So when you grow a cover crop, that essentially is harvesting the sun to put carbon back in the soil. That's a freebie if you can get it accomplished. And it's not easy. It's hard, and it maybe isn't as expensive as a big tractor and plow that you till with, but the management of covers and doing this is difficult. Timing, like John said. So, you know, we work hard to harvest our crop, and now you got to plant another crop in the fall. Could be bad weather. You don't know what the timing is, when you should do it. It's difficult. Management is even higher management.
Right. Yes. Those of us who live by the weather, it's tough because you become this sort of weather freak. You're always checking the weather reports. Yeah. Have you noticed as the soil health has improved that you have better water infiltration?
Yes. Yep. Drastically.
Wow.
And that would be the other part. Is one of the cooperators with the group has been the Burlington Water Utility, and part of they get judged. Their performance is they get judged on the stream quality downstream from their discharge from the Burlington. the Burlington waste treatment plant. And so they early on realized that if farmers could help sequester nutrients upstream from them, is that it would help them maintain or improve the water quality even, you know, as it comes down to them. And so they've been a cooperator early on with this, and their goal is water quality, which is one of the reasons why the group is called Watershed Protection.
So I'd love to talk for a moment about kind of the whole culture of farmers and farming, and the challenge of trying to kind of widen the net of farmers that are engaging in the practices that the two of you are. I mean, farmers come in all shapes and sizes, and I've known plenty of farmers growing up in Iowa, and most of the farmers I know are really good people, but I also know a lot of farmers who are very, in a sense, tradition-bound. By no means is that across the board, but, you know, you're talking about somebody who's maybe been, as you, farming for generations, and suddenly somebody is telling them to do it dramatically differently than they ever have before. So what is it like, and in by what means do you try to kind of persuade some of your fellow farmers to become part of this?
Well, for me, I go back and forth. I get to a point where I can lead a horse to water, but I can't make a drink. And then I'm okay with that until we get a big rain event, and then I go down to the creek or the canal, and I see my clean water running into a stream that looks like chocolate milk. Mm. And then how do I show the neighbors how to fix this? So then I kind of get angry that I need to do more. So it goes back and forth according to what the season is and the weather is.
And there is a scale is also part of this, is that I'm a much smaller operation than Brian is, but Brian has been able to incorporate it into his his operation. We find that farmers that are running fairly extensive operations and covering, you know, they're renting land in three different counties, is that it's difficult for them to incorporate this on a widespread basis just because it's logistically difficult. Mm. And so that some of it is just because of the way that their operation involves. It's not because they're ignoring the problem or that they don't believe in it. It just is, it economically, it just doesn't work for them.
Right, logistically, it's hard to implement.
Yeah. For somebody like myself with smaller acreage and all of my land is all within walking distance of it, is that I might be able to do some things that somebody that most of their land is rented. And you know, there are farmers in Racine and Kenosha County who their fields are 30 miles away from each other, and,
wow,
and that becomes becomes an issue as well.
So Brian, you mentioned earlier something about grants, which, and so I'm assuming what you were talking about was that there is money available maybe to help farmers engage in some of these practices? Are those the kind of grants you're talking about?
Well, the DADCAP grants for these producer-led groups, how DADCAP set that up. Yeah, we fill out an application, apply for a grant. DADCAP's, their maximum amount has been $40,000. The first 5 years, we've maxed out that grant. So that grant money, we do cost share for farmers to try these practices. So,
and by the way, what is DATCAP? What does that stand for?
Department of Agriculture, Wisconsin.
Okay, great. I should have figured that out. So that at least is something. Probably you'd like to have a whole lot more money available.
And the USDA Farm Service Agency does have a program that farmers can apply for, that they can get some cost sharing if they're doing approved practices. So it would get about $25 an acre per year that they could get, which basically would offset seed costs. Because there is an expense to this. So, yeah, there are a couple of sources. The goal is to make it economically sustainable so that you don't have to rely on outside money to establish it.
Exactly. So what do we do to make this happen on even grander and more widespread scale?
Depends on the weather.
Yeah. I just got to thank, you know, Racine County for letting us use that property in Rochester for a research farm. You know, Chad Sampson, our collaborator from the county, all of our members, our other sponsors. We have lake groups. Hmm. John has sponsored the group. We have, you know, many sponsors that, and even conventional, you know, seed companies and local co-ops help us.
Wow.
And they really don't have, I think they see this is the direction it's going, but they're not going to get no economic gain out of what we're doing. So they see it, they know it, they're helping us.
And there's a number of people is for raising the profile is that Racine County Executive Jonathan Delagrave has been supportive of what this group has done and has allowed Chad Sampson and whatnot to participate with this. And then, as Brian said, is that a number of companies that food processors and whatnot that they choose to be identified with these type of initiatives, and so that there are grants available from the company, the food processor. I don't know if you go by their initials or their name, but it's UNFI in Sturtevant. They have grants available for these type of things because that they want to be identified with this. New Holland has donated to this group. Because obviously they're local and they want to be identified with this. So.
Yeah. So there are a lot of intriguing partnerships that are emerging from this, and you have a lot of allies, which is great.
Yeah.
And the thing that I want everyone to understand is that everybody can do something to heal and promote soil health, whether you're farming or you're just gardening or whatever it may be. You have a vast expanse of land that we see so often, you know, surrounding churches and other places. That soil requires and is deserving of these kind of practices. In other words, making it healthier, not so compacted, not planted in a monoculture, making it more resilient. Because, again, you have to remember everything is connected. That water running off of that parking lot and that, you know, big turf lawn ends up in our watershed someplace, the nearest body of water. And so we can all do something on a small scale or a big scale to support and work alongside our agricultural community, because it takes all of us to do that.
Absolutely. And we all benefit.
We all benefit.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I want to mention that your organization has a really beautiful website. I just love the way it's laid out, and it's just great. So you go, it's the Watershed Protection Committee of Racine County. So it looks like the address is WPCRacineCounty.org. WPCRacineCounty.org. And you can find out all kinds of information about the organization. And there's lists some of the different collaborators. And also there's a nice little place you can click in order to donate. And I imagine donations are welcome, and that can go a long way to furthering your cause.
Absolutely.
Yep. When is the summer workshop?
It'll probably be the second week of September.
And people can register from your website?
Yes.
Oh, great.
Yep. Very good. And again, the website is WPCRacineCounty.org. And the vice chairman of the group, Brian Gunderson. Brian, it's been just great to meet you today. What a great story. I love the story about how you first sort of awakened to this, just looking at that little patch of forest, and you just made connections that a lot of the rest of us miss, and what a difference it's made in your life and in your farming operation, and then in the lives of a lot of your fellow farmers as well, following your example. So thank you so much for coming to share your story today.
Yeah, thank you very much.
And John Holloway, wonderful to have you back with us, the chairman of Paris, and someone who was really great to speak with once again. So thank you for being part of today's morning show.
Thank you much, Greg. I enjoyed it.
Great. Nan, quickly, do you have any announcements?
I do. Two things. All of the places that run summer camps for kids of all different ages are now experiencing their registration period. So, you know, any place like the Racine Dominican Eco Justice Center and Pringle Nature Center and all of those places. So get your kids signed up for summer camps. They'll be glad you sign them up, and you'll be glad you sign them up as well. Speaking of mycorrhizal fungi in the soil, on Saturday, April 29th from 9 until noon, Hawthorne Hollow is having its annual garlic mustard party. And if you don't know this yet, garlic mustard destroys the mycorrhizal component of the soil, making it completely unhealthy and inhospitable to other native plants. So you can go to Hawthorne Hollow, learn what garlic muster looks like, pull it. It's really easy to pull, and you'll be benefiting Hawthorne Hollow. You'll be benefiting the biotic community. And then after that, there's going to be lunch, and they're going to make things from garlic mustard because it is a pot herb that was brought over by our forebears. So if you don't know what it looks like, don't worry. There'll be experts on hand to help you.